Welcome to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show that is dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and folks who just like to post. And now broadcasting from the KDON Studios in fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada, Dr. Jane Karwoski and Jim Nico.
Thank you for joining us today on The Social Network Show. I'm your host, Jane Karwoski, experimental psychologist, Dr. J, along with my co-host, Jim Nico, CEO of Social Network Intermedia, LLC. Today, to delve into the slippery subject of privacy, we welcome an internationally recognized expert in cryptography, online privacy, and internet security. Lance Cottrell is a frequent public speaker at conferences such as the RSA Security Conference, Computers Freedom and Privacy Conference, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Europe, and ISS World, which trains in lawful interception, electronic surveillance, and cyber intelligence gathering. He is the principal author on multiple internet privacy and security technology patent applications. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Mr. Cottrell.
Hi, thanks. Great to be here.
Welcome, and we're really glad you're here, and we hope we keep going with you. Thank you.
Now, Lance, is there any difference between privacy and security?
You know, I think when we're talking about a lot of these topics, it's easy to sort of get sloppy with the words we're using. And so when we talk about security, generally people mean the availability, confidentiality, and integrity of your information and your system. So you've got them, you can use them. What you want to keep private is private, and nothing gets changed, things like your bank balance, right? Whereas privacy is much slipperier. It's a much harder thing to kind of wrap your hands around. But it sort of is characterized by a lot of different things, like the right to be left alone or to be anonymous or pseudonymous, you know, to use a handle instead of your real name online. Some people think of it in terms of controlling the dissemination of personal information. Mm-hmm. There's some recent situations in Europe where people are trying to say that it includes the right to delete information about yourself.
Right. And, of course, with secrets, we know that they are best kept with one person only, yourself. But why is it a tricky question to define privacy rights in relation to posting on social media?
I guess the real problem with social media is you are inherently putting your information out there. So you go into Facebook and you upload a whole bunch of comments. And some of them are public, some of them are just your friends, but your friends can freely reshare them. In this case, you sort of volunteered the information and put it out there into the public sphere. And so it's hard to know, and I think thinking on this is really still evolving, what exactly do we mean by privacy of information that you've put out into the world? You know, it'd be sort of like saying, yeah, I put up this billboard by the side of the freeway, but you know, I don't think anyone should actually pay attention to it or show it to anyone else who didn't, you know, drive by that particular location. It's very hard to control anything once it's been released.
Right. So a lot of that is a case of an evolving consciousness on the part of all of us as to just how non-private many sites are and much activity online and on the phone, too.
Absolutely. And I think it is a lot of people think of it more like the phone, where it's kind of a one-to-one interaction or just their friends. They don't realize, you know, how public that information is. And, you know, I remember hearing about this one father talking about his daughter, and he, you know, was friends with her on Facebook, watching what she said. And she said something about some party that he thought was a little inappropriate. And so he mentioned it to her that night. And she's like, Dad, you shouldn't be looking at my Facebook account. That's private.
And it, you know, sorry, not so.
Exactly. But because people treat it that way, they often put themselves at unnecessary risk. But at the same time, half the fun of using these services is the sharing. You know, if you were absolutely private, there'd be very little going on Facebook.
There's an interesting point, because even in the origination of these programs and services, if we call them services, is that it's not it's promoted as a sharing with your friends, or it was created to make it seem that way. And yet, for instance, the privacy settings default are not, in many cases, set for privacy at all. You have to know what you're doing to and get in there and proactively make it private.
Exactly. And then with something, say, like Twitter, apart from direct messages, you know, one-to-one, there's no privacy at all. And in fact, there are numerous companies that subscribe to what's called the Twitter fire hose, which is all of Twitter.
Uh-huh. Companies and the Library of Congress. And I remember hearing that. I was shocked, you know, even though I know mentally, intellectually that it's not private, somehow aggregating all of that still feels like somewhat of an invasion.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and we still haven't trained ourselves to think of it like a postcard, that you know, you're really writing this on a piece of paper that absolutely anyone could see. And it's even worse than a postcard, because that's really just, you know, maybe one or two postmen are going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas on the internet, it's absolutely, you know, mass broadcasted, huge numbers of people have access to it. But we're using the computer generally, you know, at home, you're in your office or at your desk, it feels private. Or even your phone is a very personal device. It feels like it's just you, and the fact that it's getting out there, I think maybe psychologically, it just doesn't trigger the mental cues that this is a public utterance, this is a very public thing.
Because you know, it does, the setting that you physically are in creates the illusion of privacy. And I have more questions on specifics on how people can help themselves share less or make whatever they do post a little more private. I'm Jane Karwoski, and you're listening to The Social Network Show as we speak with Lance Cottrell of theprivacyblog.com, which I highly recommend.
Jim Nico here. I want to mention something about our strategic partner, eVentures Worldwide, Invisibility Magazine, working with ClickZ Live San Francisco. I'd like to bring awareness of the event to our social media audiences. And please visit http://www.clickzlive.com/San Francisco for more information and see how you can get involved. If I can ask one quick question of Lance, because
okay.
I think he had a Lance, you had a brilliant analogy there, and I just want to mention it because I think it's helping laymen that aren't anywhere near your league understand. So the billboard analogy is amazing, because I think what you're saying, what I'm listening to you and Dr. J, the part about people feel like they're private when they're alone on their phones or their computers, and it is really hard to see that things are, especially for kids or younger people or laymen like me, to know that it's really going out there. So is there a way to take and expand that analogy of, I'm going to put it on a billboard, but I really don't want anyone to look at it? Do you think of any other analogies that might help our audience?
You know, I think that in general, that they all come down to this idea of putting things out in public. It would be maybe even a letter to the editor or something. And when you are writing a post in any of these things, imagine that you were sending it to the newspaper to be published. And even though you may be addressing the other columnist, you know, and commenting on some article, you know in the back of your head that, in fact, everyone who gets the paper is going to be able to read this. And I think that's the much more realistic kind of case in an online scenario.
Even if
you pay attention to the privacy settings, most people are not all that careful about who they friend. And it's so easy for people, and in fact for robots, to go out and friend huge numbers of real people for the pure purpose of monitoring their activities, gathering information, largely for marketing purposes, but you never know.
Right. Well, for individuals, what's the most important thing or things to protect?
I think finances has really got to be the number one thing. That's the target of so much of the attacks nowadays. You know, it used to be that hackers were just out there to kind of prove what they could do. But these days, it really is cybercrime. They're going after the money. So protecting your money is the most important. And then secondly, if you actually have secrets to protect, you know, if you have a lifestyle or a history or a medical condition or politics that are going to get you fired because they're, you know, diametrically opposed to your employer, those are things you really need to take a conscious effort to protect. And I tend to advocate focusing on the things you need to hide, hide them and protect them carefully, and then not worry about the others quite so much. Really focus in on the things that matter. And secrets are tricky. You know, if you post them anywhere, they can get out. There's a famous quote from Ben Franklin, and he said, three people may keep a secret if two of them are dead.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, as soon as you open your mouth, if you can't keep your own secrets, you can't really expect anyone else to keep them.
So what is involved in keeping your access to finances secure?
So that really comes down to protecting the accounts and protecting your computer. So when you're looking at your accounts, that's the thing that's getting compromised the most now. And it seems like a lot of those compromises are happening because of password files getting stolen. And in many cases, it isn't even the password file on the bank. But, you know, you may have accounts on dozens to hundreds of different websites out there, and most people reuse their email addresses and their account names and passwords across a great many of those different accounts. So, you know, you've got some hobby website you go to where you use your email address or Google account, say, and your password. And then that's not very secure because they figure, what do we have to protect? It's not that important. It gets hacked. They get access to this. And then they try your account name, your email address, and your password with every valuable institution out there. They try it against every major bank, every major brokerage, you know, every
medical information. Because of the speed of computers, that's not an overwhelming task for a computer to churn through all of that information or check all those possibilities. So for accounts, number one thing would be to do passwords right. And I've heard that passwords are basically broken. Now, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, the problem is that there's a lot of different ways of stealing passwords. It requires people to remember passwords. And it turns out that a computer can brute force through passwords that are surprisingly long. You know, if they're dictionary words, super easy for a computer to guess. If they're trivially modified, you know, you've changed five S's to fives or I's to ones or things like that, still really easy for computers to go through. And passwords that you can actually remember almost inherently are insecure.
We're up a creek there. So how do you deal with that? Using different and strong passwords on every website, we can't remember them. How can you manage that?
Well, the best practice right now, and hopefully we will be replacing passwords with something better soon, but in the meantime, password managers are the key. There's a bunch of them out there. There's LastPass. I use one called 1Password that will allow you to automatically keep track of the passwords on every account. It will generate them for you. It'll automatically fill in the forms. So you don't need to remember any of the passwords. You just need to remember one password, hopefully a good one, that unlocks your vault. And they're actually getting really cool. They'll sync between different computers and sync between your phone and your tablet and whatever you have. But the great thing is then, once you've got this remembering your passwords for you, you can free up your gray matter to do more interesting things. And all your passwords can now become insane. Now, I've sort of defaulted to 20-character random alphanumeric passwords. Basically, I'll go as long as the website will let me go, because I don't care. I don't even make an effort to remember any of them. They're all completely impossible. But I've got the security of the size of the password, and because I just let it randomly generate all of them, I never reuse a password. So if that random low-security hobby site gets compromised, it doesn't really affect me because that password isn't also the password to my bank.
So is that password manager, is that secure?
It is fairly secure. And that's where the security of your computer comes in, because a lot of attackers now are stealing things by doing keyboard sniffers and screen grabbers in your computer. So once someone manages to get, say, a virus or malware on your computer, one of the number one things they're waiting for you to do is log into your bank. And as soon as you log into that bank account, they actually watch what password you type in. capture it, and upload it. So the next thing is you need to make sure that your computer itself doesn't get attacked. Now, you know, you have more control over that because, you know, hacking of some other website out on the internet, you don't know how they secured things. But on your own computer, the two big keys are the software you install, making sure you only get and install software from known trusted sources. You know, don't just kind of install games and stuff willy-nilly.
For instance, if you got an email that advertised a piece of software, or a lot of younger people don't use email very much at all, it might come through some other.
Right, you get a tweet, you get a Facebook message, you get whatever. You know, you always want to make sure: do you know this company? Are they reputable? And then don't follow the links. If someone sends you a message with a link in it and you click on it, often the message appears to come from someone legitimate, but actually it's bouncing through some other website that'll be able to infect your computer. So just as a rule, don't click on links in emails. Go ahead and type them in. Make sure that they kind of make sense, that they're going where you think you should be going, because very often those email or tweet or other message-based links are looking like they're legitimate, but are going to actually bounce you through some bad guy web server where they'll then do a drive-by download, install bad stuff on your computer, and take it over.
A drive-by download.
Jesus, this thing is getting more and more crazy.
Well, there's one really simple and quick thing that I've been doing on weird-looking messages, and that is click on show details or something, just whatever will show the entire email address that it's coming from. And if it doesn't come from the company, that's a real red flag.
Right, right.
Although, like you say, it's better to just assume it's not coming from the company, but it is interesting.
Right. Most of the phishing attacks are sloppy, and you're right. The from address will look wrong, or it'll be formatted wrong, or, you know, if you hover over the link, the text of the link looks right, but when you hover over it, it's got a different URL. Smart attackers can get around that, and there are ways of making it so that it really does look accurate. So, you know, if I get something from my bank, it says, "We've got a message for you," just pop open the window and type in your bank's address, you know, directly. That way, no possibility that there's something wonky about that email or about the domain, you know, that is going to trick you into going somewhere you didn't want to go.
Lance, could you just repeat that one? Okay, LastPass I've heard of. Can you repeat is it onepassword.com?
Yeah, and it's the number one.
Oh, so oh, okay.
Digit one.
Thank
password.
You. Thank
yeah.
you.
Okay, and there, the browser, any suggestions on that can help us just kind of keep things clean or
safer? Well, one of the tricks is, with the browser, when you're done visiting a website that is sensitive, banking, you know, being the most important probably, after you close the window, make sure you quit the program completely. So it's not just that tab that's closed or that window. You know, if the icon shows up as that, you know, down at the bottom of the screen in Windows, or if you're tabbing through on the Mac, if that still shows as active, make sure you actually quit it all the way.
Now, are you're referring not just to the website, but to like Safari or Firefox or Internet Explorer, Chrome, and so forth?
Exactly. Quit the program completely and then launch it again to keep going. Because there's a bunch of things, there's cookies, there's cache, there's history, there's a lot of stuff that gets left floating around in memory, and it's possible for other websites to use what's called cross-site scripting attacks to get at some of that information, and it might allow them to get at your data. So, and in fact, because you may have already visited something risky, your best practice would be either quit your current browser or launch a brand new browser. So, for example, if I'm surfing along in Chrome and I want to go to my bank, I may launch Firefox, right? Haven't been using Firefox, do my banking, and then quit Firefox so that, you know, Chrome's over in one window. It's not going to be having access to my Firefox or whatever I'm using. And if I'm going somewhere that I think is actually kind of shady, and this is sort of a power user move, but I actually run a virtual machine. and I run a browser inside of that. And then when I'm done, I roll back the virtual machine to a snapshot, which completely destroys all changes since last time I used it.
That sounds fascinating. We'll go into that in another show.
Yeah, I mean, this is fascinating. I got to learn about this stuff. Cross-eyed.
You lost me at virtual machine, but just in the interest of getting to some of the more basic things that we wanted to today, then so closing out of the browser completely, and what about ixquick.com? That's supposed to be or go duck.
Start page. That's another one. Duck go. Start page. You know, the ones that say they're more secure, that they don't save your info. Yeah, what do you think of those?
They actually they do some cool stuff. So they're search engines, kind of like Google. So when you search for information, you know, they're returning the queries. And in fact, they're really riding on top of other services in general. And what they do is they don't log your searches, because that is a huge amount of information in your search history. The problem becomes, as soon as you click on one of those links and actually go to the target site, they're immediately tracking you again. Now, you know, you can...
Unless you go through a proxy, right?
You go through some sort of a proxy and...
On ixquick.com, it gives you the choice of just going directly. I mean, in... Let's face it, a lot of services don't work, and that's another thing I wanted to ask you about, Java and Adobe Flash. Why are those so touchy? You know, people are always warning you about that.
Well, it's because they are sort of full programming languages, and they have a whole set of vulnerabilities. Most of the compromises that we've seen in browsers have actually not been to the browser themselves, but have been some vulnerability in the Flash engine, the thing that runs the Flash program, or the Java engine. So if someone can write a clever piece of code, it then breaks the engine and gets access to the underlying computer, and it can install some software, it can, you know, make some file system changes or what have you. It breaks out of what's called the sandbox. And then can start mucking around with your underlying computer. And so all of those kind of things are out there. And that's really the problem with a lot of browsers, is they have so many different ones. I mean, even HTML is becoming a programming language now with HTML5. JavaScript is a full programming language. And each one of these has the potential to contain, and really almost a surety of containing, errors and bugs in the programming language interpreter that would allow an attacker potentially to get control of your computer.
What about the idea that computer parts manufactured in China, for instance, have built-in malware or spyware?
There have been some examples of that, where people have found batches of parts coming from different countries where they were pre-installed with some kind of malware. It may even depend on who you are, because, you know, if you order parts, they're often directly shipped. You know, if you order a computer, it may be directly shipped from China, and you know, the odds are they're not trying to infect most of them, because there'd be huge backlash. But for a small producer or someone who's shipping to someone of particular interest, you know, there's no way of knowing what kind of changes might have been made.
Sort of a stowaway bit of code.
National intelligence services have been doing this for a long time, intercepting devices, packages, things like that, modifying them, inserting, you know, new software or new hardware, or tracking devices, and then, you know, putting them back into the mail stream and sending them on their way.
I've mentioned great courses before from the teaching company in Chantilly, Virginia, and that is one of my favorite sources of continuing education. And there is a cybersecurity, cyber safety set of lectures by Professor Paul Rosenzweig, and that is just awesome. You know, there's a quote I wanted to share from Who Owns the Future by Jaron Lanier, and he refers to the hacker's paradise, and their attitude is basically open up your life to the net, all you ordinary people, the world's about to become transparent, and that will be the beginning of a golden age. Sharing is good. However, encrypt your life like crazy, use VPN, etc. And what it boils down to is that better your computer skills, or only the smartest people can make no sound in the digital forest. So it's in a sense that technologists are becoming a privileged class, but we're doing our part to combat that. And we thank you very much, Lance, for joining us today.
Oh, thanks very much. It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Do you have any, I wanted to mention that your blog, your content at theprivacyblog.com is excellent. For those of you who would like to build on what you have heard today, you can add to your knowledge little by little. And thank you for listening. For email updates, just click the blog tab of thesocialnetworkshow.com and fill out the form for subscriptions. And next week, we're going to welcome Dori Clark, who is just top in marketing and branding. Her recent book, Reinventing You, is very popular in business circles. She blogs for Forbes, Harvard Business Review, etc. So we'll be looking forward to that. Thank you so much for joining us. And as usual, have fun and be safe online and off.